You're listening to the Outclassed podcast with Mike Redding and Blake Seifert, exploring excellence in teaching, tech, and leadership.
Hi there, welcome back to the Outclassed podcast. It's great to be with you again this week. Looking forward to spending episode 10 with you, Blake. We made double figures.
Double figures, we made it. We're committed. This is it. That's good. Excited to be here, Mike. Always enjoy these every week. It's been the highlight of my week the last few weeks.
Yeah, I was just reflecting on the podcast. I was talking to a number of other people who started podcasts during COVID lockdown because they had all this extra time on their hands and they thought they might as well get to something that they've been wanting to do for a long time and finally got to it because they had the time. And for you and I, it was almost the opposite, wasn't it? We didn't have the time, but we're like, man, we just need to do it. And COVID just so happened to come into the mix of it. So, you know, we kind of joke we made double figures, but to be honest, with the busyness of things that have been going on, pretty stoked that we've set aside some time each week to have a chat.
Me too, absolutely. And you know, we've been covering all sorts of topics, and I suppose that trend will continue today as well.
Yeah. I just want to pick up a couple of things that I saw in the news over the last couple of weeks, and one was an article by in the Education Review, just talking a little bit about some of the comments that Hattie has had to make on whether or not the fact that students are in a school or not actually matters. And so I guess he asked the question, does it matter that students are not in a physical place called school? And so I think that's a pretty interesting question to be asking. I know there's a lot of people talking around the concept of equity and social and emotional stuff that comes with being connected together. But it's interesting in terms of where he takes that in terms of his insights, because he says that there's no meta-analysis around the effect of the length of a school year, you know, in terms of is it positive or negative. But he does mention that Australia and the US have some of the longest school days in the year across the OECD. And he actually makes this comment that he says that if you took out a whole term or 10 weeks or a quarter of the year, we would still have more school time compared to Finland, Estonia, Korea, and Sweden, and all of those outranking us. So really interesting about what result do we get from actually being in school.
I'm not sure. Outranking us in PISA results, you should mention there as well. So, yep. You know, I suppose we could go into a diatribe about PISA here, but there is kind of a line of thinking, whether I agree with it or not, I'm not sure, but there's a line of thinking around, I'm keen to hear what you think on this, Mike, that PISA is perhaps not a great method of identifying 21st century skills. It's sort of a last century tool for identifying people who can pass tests. And to a degree, like we see that in international students, where if you talk to teachers who have, you know, who coordinate international programs, often, you know, they'll come over and not be used to the culture of inquiry. They're used to the culture of tell me what process you want me to follow. Mm-hmm. I will learn that process and I'll follow it. So when you have open-ended group projects or things like that, where they say, well, you have to come up with the topic, they come back to the teacher. So what do you want me to put down? Yeah. And I think that is an artifact of, well, that kind of culture is an artifact of a lot of the schools worshipping at the altar of PISA in developed countries. So certainly an interesting observation about the time we spend in schools, because I wonder how, if they correlate or relate at all. I mean, he's saying there's no meta-analysis, right?
Yeah, and he actually relates it back to New Zealand in Christchurch with the earthquakes. A lot of the schools obviously were shut down and there was a lot of trauma in that space. And a lot of teachers were asking for some dispensation for their students in terms of the high school exams. And he says at the time, based on the research he'd done on long-term strikes and lockouts of schools, that being away from school doesn't really make that much different. Especially he's talking about in the junior school years, maybe intermediate schools, before you start getting into more of that, you know, subject specific, subject matter expert stuff. But he said he argued during that time that you shouldn't have any extra special dispensation. And he actually says that he found that the performance of the Christchurch students went up. And as the schools resumed, the scores actually started settling back down. So he's making he's drawing some dotted points, I guess, to some interesting data that is out there.
Yeah, that is interesting. And for those listening who aren't familiar with what meta-analysis is, basically overview, a macro view of a whole bunch of smaller research that tries to tie together concepts, themes, and outcomes of those researchers in a way that can be kind of brought to a conclusion or at least show you a correlation of that data. So often meta-analysis won't draw a causation, but it will draw a correlation to say when this happens, this likely happens as well. But it won't say when this happens, this will happen. Yeah. But it can be a useful tool. It can be used to make predictions and things like that. But it is a tricky one. What do we do with all these year 12s that are sitting their exams that now have to grapple with, well, okay, was it a fair lockdown if my state was locked down for 2 weeks longer than your state, but we're all working towards a national score, so we're all competing against each other on an unfair playing field? And, you know, it might be the other way. It might be like the people who have more time at home, some of those people who are in privileged positions to have access to all the data and good online systems at their school excel beyond the schools that didn't have those systems in place, but otherwise would have done really well. So it's very individual, and I think there's a lot of grey between there, isn't there?
Yeah, I know in New Zealand, year 13, which is a graduating year, and it must be in year 12 and 13 at least, that they've taken a percentage of your credit points off you. So in year 12, for instance, you have to get 80 credit points to pass the year. And so they've dropped that down to 60 this year. And I'm not sure what they're doing for year 13. So they're actually looking at that examination process. And in New Zealand, it is quite different to Australia and America and some of those other places where you can do no external. You don't have to sit an exam if you can get enough internal credits to pass. But have you heard if there's anything around the HSC or any of those final exams around Australia, if they've made any announcements around what they're doing around those?
I haven't heard, but they may have made announcements. I'm not sure what the inner workings are. There's a lot of talk at the moment, but nothing final yet, I don't think.
Yeah, maybe we should do some research and we'll come back next week on that and unpack it a bit more. But interestingly, in that article, he does say that he feels like the reason that results went up in those Christchurch earthquakes and could possibly happen the same in COVID was that teachers start tailoring the learning to what students can do, not so much what they can't do. Mm. So I guess, you know, when you're at school and the students are in front of you, you're often thinking about what the students can do. You know, you just make these assumptions. So they kind of just strip away all the busy work and all the dross, I guess, and they get right to the point. And so I think maybe that focused, more timely curriculum, there's that law that says task expands to the time that you give it. When you have less time on, maybe that's something that you can get through a whole lot more work. It's more meaningful work. It's more targeted. And so produces a better result.
The dross. Mm. I love that word, Mike. I hadn't heard that before. I just looked it up. Dross. Beautiful.
Yeah, it's a good one.
I'm going to bring that to this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the discussions we've had in previous episodes around even my own kids starting an online school a year and a half ago, how they can get through their work a whole lot better at a higher standard. There's less context switching. I mean, we've had a lot of these discussions backwards and forwards over the last couple of months, but I think there's something in that in terms of maybe that's one of the things that the government should be looking at, is that correlation between time spent in class and an outcome.
So let me ask you this, Mike. Do you think the state of play currently, the way we school now, is in need of a shakeup? Do you think this is an opportunity for schools to add a mix in or shake up the way they're delivering content? Do you think that that has to happen now? This is the time? Or do you think that there is still a place for the traditional, you know, turn up to six periods a day schooling, particularly in high school?
I think basically you don't want to get caught into a reactionary scenario where you're just reacting all the time. And I think education does that a little bit in one sense, like we make changes based on reactions, pressure or something like that. So I think, like, I don't start with a position that education is broken, where you hear a lot of people on the speaking circuit, they want to start from that point. So, you know, everything's broken. We need to re-engineer the whole system. I don't think that education needs transformation as such in terms of, like, absolutely everything has to go out the window and we need to rebuild from the ground up. But I do think there's massive opportunity to look at what's worked and what hasn't worked and have the opportunity to, I guess, to check in with where things are at, check in with the community, check in with our students, and make some changes based on that. It does worry me that you know, some schools maybe just be hanging in there just to go back to business as usual and sit back down inside your comfort zone. I'm really hoping that schools do take the opportunity to reflect a little bit and then to move forward with some new ideas for sure.
Yeah. So what you're sort of saying, if I'm paraphrasing, understanding you correctly, is that you're not entirely sure that current status quo is reaching its full potential, that there are opportunities for more focus in terms of the schooling.
Well, there's always room for improvement. I don't think there's ever, you can't get to perfection, because while you're working in a system full of people, there's always going to be flaws and things that could be done better. So I guess I always start off by saying, I don't think education's broken, because people usually just say that to sell a ticket to a conference and then give you a bunch of hype and talk about it and don't actually give you any strategies to move forward and do anything different. But it's no different to industry right now. So have a look at all the businesses right now that laying off staff, redoing their systems, re-engineering and transforming their technology stacks so that they can come out of this stronger, faster, leaner. And this is a perfect opportunity to do it, right? And I think the schools are have the exact same opportunity afforded to them. We've just got to be strategic about how we go about that. So I would hope that the education systems, not even education as a whole, but individual schools would emerge from this stronger, faster, more effective and efficient than what they were going into it, and use COVID as the lever that we would start to have some of these conversations.
Mm. And I think that's about also empowering yourself as a school and saying, let's throw out the rule book for a moment and just ideate and think, what is possible? What can we do that we weren't doing before? You know, can we move to 2 days a week off, or can we move to chunks of time where there's, you know, the SWAT vac idea. I don't know if you remember that, where you go away before exams and you study for 2 weeks supposedly. But my issue with that when I did it was I'd never done that before. Mm. And then I turn up to a 2 week period where I'm supposed to be studying for exams at home, unset up, unprepared. If you're coming from an environment where you've done that consistently through your high school career, or even at primary school to some degree, I think that there is an opportunity there to bring in a little more cohesion in the, you know, the exam process and the high stakes testing side of things.
Yeah.
But of course, the cynic in me, the critic in me, is always thinking about, you know, how this marries into, you know, we're able to deliver clearer content and less dross, as you put it, Mike, in our delivery of content. But then are we just getting better at creating high stakes test takers, and we're not then including all the stuff that's omitted is all the human side, the collaboration side, the problem solving side, and the kind of having to work with others, where it just gets boiled down into like a little Loom video for 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, I think if I reflect on teaching, the best teaching I ever did was the first year I switched from teaching science to teaching history and geography. And I had very little knowledge in that subject. I was just meant to be holding the fort for a couple of weeks between teaching gigs, and ended up doing it for 4 years, I think, in that department. But the best teaching I did was at the very start of that, when I had no resources, no context, I had no pre-planned lessons. I was learning it and then teaching it. And not only was it the best teaching I did, it was the best results that we ever got.
So why? Why was it the best teaching?
Because you distill everything down to, this is what you've got to do. This is what you have to know. These are the fundamentals. And I was processing it in a way that it made sense, that this followed this, which followed this, and I could scaffold it as we went. I didn't come into it teaching with a preconceived understanding. Like, you know, when you don't know what you don't know, but sometimes you don't know what you do know. And so you come in with this whole lot of information in front of you that you just assume everybody else has. And so you just teach like they've got a context or an understanding. Because I stripped it back, it was laser targeted. And I think teachers are hoarders. Let's be honest. They got filing cabinets full of stuff. They got Google Drive cabinet, drive folders full of stuff. And then we always add on. We keep gathering new resources, new newspaper articles, new ideas, and we never actually clean out. So I think there's something in that. And that comes back to that article, right? Where it says you can, if you focus on what you need to get done in a shorter amount of time, not only will you do it to the same standard, you'll probably get a better standard out of it.
Yeah, I agree. And you heard it here first. Teachers are hoarders. Please send all your hate to at Mike Redding on Twitter.
Oh, prove me. Take a photo of your filing cabinet and prove me otherwise. There's the real challenge.
All right. That's laid down now. Let's see who can send us their tweets.
Yeah.
clean desk,
hashtag outclass podcast, and we'll be more than happy to reply.
Sounds good. So in the news as well this week, we've got Slack partnering with Amazon, which is an interesting play. And Amazon have kind of been a sleeper in education. I don't know how you feel about this, Mike, but they're in the background. They obviously provide AWS, for those who don't know, is like the biggest web serving company on the internet, pretty much. I think some enormous amount of the internet runs on it. I don't want to quote it and get it wrong, but an enormous amount of the internet runs on AWS. A lot of services you use every day, things like Netflix, run on AWS. And yeah, we just saw in the news that Slack have partnered with them. Amazon's entire workforce is going to use the Slack platform, the real-time chat platform, which is obviously a competitor to Microsoft Teams and Google Chat as well, which we have discussed, I believe, as episode 6, was it, Mike?
6, yep.
Yeah, episode 6, way back when. So yeah, an interesting move from Slack, and it kind of ties them. They're leveraging some of Amazon's services. It's not a partnership, I don't think, but they're willing to kind of bring in the video chat from Amazon, which is called Amazon Chime. That's their kind of video chat, and use that to power the voice and video and screen sharing stuff inside of Slack, which has always been a weak point, I think, of their software. And it kind of ratchets them up and puts them in a good position to compete a bit with the juggernaut of Teams, which is just kind of taking over the world.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, like we talked about in episode 6, I think it's probably, if you look at that mass communication platforms, it would be Slack versus Teams at the moment. There's no one else really competing that space for them. I don't know how much partnering up. I think it says in the article, and we'll again link that in the show notes, but that Amazon have agreed to use Slack as their main platform, which is interesting, and that it's going to run on it. How that goes into being able to compete against Microsoft and Teams, I'm not exactly sure, but I guess it goes a long way when you start looking at the way in which Amazon can start connecting in. And I know that, like you said, they're not doing much in the education space. They did try, and it was a pretty half-hearted attempt, to be honest. What they produced wasn't great. I'll link up to it so you can have a look at it. It was basically doing some publishing stuff and trying to get some videos online and some printing worksheets, but it was very, I don't know, I'd like to say 1980s in a sense, like watch this video and answer these questions.
So I don't think that's the tools that they were providing, but yeah. They also have a course or a like an introductory thing they were trying to push to high schools where you could learn how to use AWS, like the whole internet, you know, kind of leverages AWS.
Yeah.
And you can get your kids in there creating instances for free, setting up virtual machines, EC2 instances, and running up web servers and kind of actually doing the real stuff that you'd be doing if you're working for a, you know, web firm. So
yeah,
that was a cool initiative. I think that's still running, but
yeah, it is AWS Educate.
Yeah. As with all these things, it requires teachers to be confident to kind of use it. And it's a whole new thing for most teachers. You know, most teachers kind of do the basic set up a website and that's about it. And that's all they're comfortable with. And that makes sense, right? So yeah, it's a tricky one, that trying to get, you know, highly skilled teachers in these IT roles in schools. How do you keep them there? How do you stop? If they're actually any good, why would they be working in the school? You know, that's always the old trope, isn't it? So I don't know how we move forward with those kind of, you know, initiatives when they require such a high skill set, or at least a modern skill set, to entice young teachers to take them on.
Yeah, super hard. I mean, even technical people, if you're deep in Microsoft and you said go to AWS and work, they'd be like, it's a completely different system. I'd have to learn it. And then if you move to Google Cloud, it's completely different again.
That is getting better with Kubernetes and Docker. Things are starting to be standardized, but yeah, I agree.
Yeah, in terms of principles and understanding, but in terms of the deep work, there's like, yeah, we've been talking to some IT people around that and they say it's very hard to switch from one to the other.
It's like saying technology. People say, I work in IT. Like, well, that's an enormous umbrella term. You know, there's the architects in IT that are just for network, that know nothing about deploying Windows machines, and they know nothing about Linux administration. They know nothing about web development, and they know nothing about, you know, iPad and iOS development. So it's a tricky space in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. 100% agree. Awesome. Let's jump into today's topic. And we're actually going to turn this into a bit of a mini series, this part, looking at school transformation. And I think we've already touched on it a little bit today when you asked me the question around that. And so, yeah, it'll be interesting. I think that education's gone through a bit of what I like to call an evolution. Everyone talks about like a revolution in education. This is going to revolutionize education. You've probably heard that spoken at a conference, or you've heard about some tool that's going to revolutionize education. And they all seem to fall flat for one reason or another. They don't actually, you know, this is going to be the thing that changes everything. This is going to be the lever. This is going to be the tool, the understanding, the workflow. And we don't ever seem to have that massive shift that everybody's thinking of. But I think if you know, talking as an ex-science teacher, if you talk about the concept of evolution, evolution is change over time. And so I think that's what happens with education, is that you just get little changes. But you look back over a period of time and you go, okay, so we have seen some change. But maybe it's so slow you don't even see it. But there are like definitely...
You look back at iPhones, you know, and you look at an iPhone 5 years ago, and in the feature set, it'll surprise you. I think I was looking back a few years ago, like, you know, the first iPhone that came out, I think it was 2009, was horrendous, you know, no app store, all these other things. So it's sort of funny how, you know, you look at it, there's no big revolution after the iPhone launches. It's like there's just tiny little steps, and then all of a sudden you have this device that like does everything and has a camera as good as your SLR and doing crazy stuff.
Yeah, and it's like an 11 year process.
Yeah, so, and it doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah, if you're a principal in a school, maybe you need to look at a 10 or 11 year process to bring this thing through, and you've got like amazing growth. And there's that saying that's a leadership saying, that people always overestimate what you can achieve in a short amount of time, but you underestimate what you could achieve if you just stayed for a long time, consistent, plugging away. Mm. You get that compounding interest on your efforts, so to speak. So yeah, let's dig into having a little bit of a look at this concept of school transformation, and we'll break down. There's actually 7 elements, and a lot of this is taken from the work that Google have done around their education transformation framework. And to be honest, we've looked at Apple's 8 elements, and we've looked at Microsoft's education transformation framework as well. And it's really interesting because we're a partner company of all three. We get all of their documentation, all of their best practice guides, all of the research, the case studies, all the bits and pieces that come with it. And when we sit down and we look at them, we find that fundamentally Google, Apple, and Microsoft all agree that there are 7 elements that you need to have in any school transformation plan. And this is using technology, obviously, as a leader or the lever to bring about that change. But so there's 7 elements you need to look at. The only element that Google, Apple, and Microsoft disagree on is which device is best. So in terms of Apple, obviously...
Wait. Let me guess.
Yeah.
does Apple like the Apple devices? I'm guessing.
Yeah, funny enough.
And you just, on that, so Apple have a school transformation guide, do they? I'm not aware of any of their literature. In fact, they're very quiet on the education front usually.
Yep, you gotta know, be behind the scenes. So yeah, it's called Apple's 8 Elements. So if you look it up on your bookstop, you'll be able to grab it. And it's anything that Apple do is going to be slick, right? Really nicely designed book. It's got interactive elements where you can answer questions and slide things around and use it with your leadership teams as a really interactive leadership tool, which is great. Google and Microsoft have got similar things. But yeah, so I mean, you know, Apple are going to talk about the iPad. They're going to talk, Google's going to talk about the Chromebook, and Microsoft are going to talk about the PC with a pen. So you just know that's coming. But in terms of the other 7 elements, they all 100% agree. They line up on what you need.
Yeah, the Apple one you have to do through Apple Books, so that kind of precludes 3/4 of the population right there, I think.
unless you can find an iPad lying around, you'll
get
it. So yeah, so let's unpack some of this. I'll link out to this in the show notes so people can see a graphic of this and do it. The way I kind of see it, it's like a wine barrel. So, you know, in a wine barrel, you got all the different staves. So a wine barrel is made up of individual slats of wood, and they're all brought together. They put a ring over it and it holds the staves together. If you imagine that wine barrel, that one of those staves is lower than all the others, you can keep building the other ones really, really high. But if you pour wine or water or liquid into a wine barrel, it's always going to pour out at the lowest point. So sometimes when we're working with schools on their school transformation projects, what we find is that a school will naturally be really strong in 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 of these elements, and they keep focusing on it, and building it stronger and stronger, but they don't realize there's just one element that's missing in their plan. And so all of their effort is lowering out, like running out at that lowest point. So it's one of those things, you've got to be aware of what the seven elements are. And again, Google, Apple, Microsoft all agree. If they agree, there's probably something in it. And you just need to make sure that you're holistically looking at each of these seven elements to make that happen. So I'll just run through the seven elements, and then what we'll do is we'll just unpack each of these seven elements over the next 7 weeks or so, and just show you what other schools are doing in this space, give you some ideas for you to run with your leadership teams or to spark conversations in your school. We'll give you a whole bunch of resources. Google's got a really nice paint by numbers almost approach, where it just says, for the first element is vision. And so it says, well, here's the steps that you need to do to make sure your vision's rock solid. And it just takes you through like a 4-step process and shows you exactly what you need to do. So we'll link all of that up in the show notes as well. Let's just quickly run through each of these seven, and I'll give you just a real quick commentary on each of these at a high level. And then, as I said, we'll just dig into them as we go over the next few episodes. So the first one's vision. And so, you know, this is something that schools always talk about. Like, we know what our school vision is. We've got it in our pamphlets, it's on our wall or whatever. The problem with vision, if you think about the word, it implies that you can see. And so when we talk about vision, we've got a survey that we use in schools, and we ask the school leadership team and we survey the teacher team separately, and we try and see where there's congruency and where there's a miss between what the leadership team think are happening in the school and what the teaching team are saying is actually happening. And so one of the questions we ask on that survey is, in one sentence or so, explain to us what your school vision is. And so out of, goodness knows how many schools we've done this with, let's be conservative and say 100, it's well over that. How many schools do you reckon, Blake, have come back with their leadership team who have all been 100% been able to tell us what their school vision is?
Zero.
Exactly. Not one. Haven't had a single school that have come back where the whole leadership team have come and said, here's our school vision in a concise way. They'll talk about, you know, innovative learning environments. They'll talk about student outcomes. They might talk about student welfare. They'll talk about, like, they'll use all these buzzwords, but no one is saying the same thing, and you can't get them on. And then you go to the teaching team and God help us all, right? So in one of those things, not everyone's seeing the same thing. And so we need to understand that when it comes to vision, we speak in pictures, not in words. That's the whole concept of vision. So quite often when a principal's casting vision for the teaching team, they're using words that are open to interpretation. So if I said to you, we want to be an innovative school, what does that mean? Right? Because you right now are thinking, well, I know what innovative school means. It means this, this, and this. And I'm thinking something completely different. So it's not good enough to even have everybody on the same page knowing the buzzwords or, you know, what our descriptive words are. We actually need to know, what does that look like in practice? And so we quite often say to principals and leadership teams, you should be able to walk around the school and say, that's it, that's it, that's not it, but what is it? Like, how does a teaching team know if they're on it or not?
Yeah, that'll be good when we explore that and looking at, you know, how to share that practice and shared understanding and things. That's a big part of it for sure.
Yeah. So, like, we don't want people to gloss over that because we go vision and everyone goes, yep, we've got a school vision. Next. So, but what we do is go, okay, well, let's just unpack that for a second and see if we're all seeing the same thing. The next one, I think, and these aren't, and again, this is not in order of importance necessarily, because you do need to focus on all seven. But obviously, if you've got no vision, well, the rest might as well not be there. The next one, I think, is team and culture. And so this is a massive one, right? And it's quite hard for schools in one sense, because in a lot of schools, you don't necessarily get to choose who's on your team. So in business, you can hire people for particular niche skill sets to plug holes, to grow your market and so on, but schools don't necessarily get that luxury. But at the same time, it's the team that's either going to take you forward or hold you back. And when it comes to team and culture, culture is massive, because the definition of culture is, that's just what we do around here. So when you're in a culture, you don't even realize that you're doing it, because you're just doing it without even thinking. It's on autopilot. So this is why schools will introduce a new vision, or they'll introduce a new initiative, and the culture doesn't sustain it. And the teachers don't, they're not actively walking around being anti it. It's just that the culture is not there to drive it forward. So if you think about change and schools have been stuck in the mud, some schools are really resistant to change, not because they actively want to, it's just that's not what they do. So you really need to think that one through. And I mean, you would have seen it, Blake, all the time with schools that sometimes a make or break thing is that they've just got a top team that understand each other, who move forward, who've got each other's backs. And that over time, culture just gets built that this is just what we do at this school, right?
Yeah, and that often happens inadvertently. And then people sort of look back and think, what did we do for that? Well, we just happen to have people with a shared understanding who are going ahead. What's hard to do and what the challenge for, I think, most schools, if we say most schools, is to have their team be able to own their roles, to work together towards that common vision. And again, like, I'm not sure if these are in order, Mike, but they sort of sound like they are, in a sense that vision really overrides everything.
Yep.
And the teams are there to fulfill that vision. And so if you've got good teams with good communication skills, and of course, sometimes you have to do some professional development, you have to bring people up with you. And that's where, you know, professional development comes in, and plans and self-assessments, like we've discussed previously. That's where all of that kind of plays a big role. But it's important that your teams, you know what their role is, understand the intent of their actions. You know, what's the point of a curriculum committee? What's the point of, you know, anything, a lab technician? What are you contributing to the overall, you know, running of the school? So it's about kind of tying yourself and your vision and your faculties or your areas of the school to the main vision of the school, whether you're the principal or the finance officer.
Yeah. And when we break this down for principals, we even explain, like, we give them, like, there's a whole process, we'll go into it, but 12-week sprints and who's accountable for what over that 12 weeks, and setting up an accountability culture where it's not okay not to deliver. But you know, they say when it comes to culture, it takes 3 to 5 years to develop culture if you're focused on it. So if you think about that in terms of this is a long-term game, you don't develop culture overnight because it has to become subconscious. It takes a while to get to that.
Yeah, it's muscle memory that you don't even think twice about it. Like turning up to meetings on time, those kind of little small things, even trying to change that. You can't just say, right, everyone has to turn up on time and then expect it to happen tomorrow. You've got to have it, you know, set up as norms that you constantly repeat in meetings. You've got to have it distributed into all meetings in the school. You've got to have it. Yeah, any change like that is a big undertaking. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of schools see high performing schools. I see schools that are performing beyond their means and they think, oh, let's take their secret sauce. But sometimes they've just got good operators that are all have an unspoken shared vision and they just happen to click and move forward. And I think that can happen sometimes. Mm. But the challenge is for the big middle, for the most schools, is to actually build that, is to unpick and kind of define what that culture is, and how that's much, much harder than just having high-performing people in all your top roles and everything works smoothly because you're all on the same page.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. And you're right. It's one of those things that takes time. It's my favorite topic to talk on, to be honest. Like, I love digging into culture and teams because at the end of the day, that's really what's going to make or break you. You can have the clearest vision, the most catchy thing, clearly articulated, everyone can see it, and then you don't have the team or the culture to get you there, you know, that's going to be the thing that trips you up. So,
or the ambition as well. And I totally agree. You've got to, everything starts with vision, and I love talking about it as well. But I am also cognizant that a large amount of people groan at it. You hear, I do a vision activity or, you know, vision building or vision casting. God, here we go again. This is all just fluff. And I've had staff members of mine come up to me after our strategy days and say, you know, I thought that was going to be, you know, just sit back and roll my eyes into the back of my head, but actually it makes sense. Like, I'm connected to what we're doing. I understand it. So I think, you know, if you don't want people to groan, you really got to not miss your chance there. Make sure you are connecting your vision down the line. But of course, we'll talk about all of that, but we can't help ourselves, Mike.
I know. I love it. It's one of my, as I said, favorite topics to talk about with school leaders. It's so powerful. So we've got vision, we've got team and culture. They really are the most two that you need to get your vision set. You need to get your team working and culture. And then the rest of them, you just keep your eye on and just keep moving them up and down, putting your attention on them when you need to. But the next one I think is professional development. So what's your approach to that? And so one of the distinctions we like to make around professional development is, for us at Using Technology Better, we don't like to call it professional development. No, we like to call it people development. And it sounds a little bit like a HR department or something like that, and I get it. But the problem is when you start talking about professionally developing somebody, you see them as a program or a number to be moved, or like it takes the human element out of it a little bit. It's like, come here, I'm going to do something to you. But when you talk about people development, that's looking at people's skill sets and how can I help you and how can we help you move to the next level. And one of the things we talk about in professional development or people development is that every person in the school, regardless of position, should be taking their next step of improvement. It should not be okay that we're not learning, that we're not progressing, because we want to be modeling that for our students. And so everyone should be taking their next step, but not everyone should be taking the same step. And so what does that look like to reimagine and redevelop program of works where teachers are being looked after, that they're being able to, you know, work in their skill set that they need to, being able to set their own goals and, you know, not have a lid put on them or not have everything done to them in that sense. So there's a lot of work that can be done in that space around how do we develop our people.
People development, completely agree again, that it does have to go beyond just professional skills. I think you need to talk about character. You need to talk about, especially in education. I mean, there's no kind of wider gamut of a business, is there, where we're really talking about fully developing children, or I think we are, more than just taking tests. We want to know that our staff, you know, understand the nuances of morality and these kind of abstract concepts, even though they might seem strange. I think anyone that's under my management or under my leadership, I want them to feel like they're getting better as a person. Not just I'm better at my job and I can write a really good assessment now, but like, am I actually improving as a person? Because the better that I can control my time management skills, the better that I can control and understand emotional relationships with people, the better maybe my home life's going to be, the better my, you know, relationship with my kids is going to be, and the better, you know, the better person I can bring to the school and bring to my job. And I think that's so important, to develop the whole person, not just the parts. I mean, it's a very industrial age thing to say, your job is to screw caps onto toothpaste in the factory, so I'm just going to develop your skills at screwing caps on in factories, but sort of missing the whole thing that you can't get to work on time because you don't have any organizational skills. And, you know, it's obviously not that extreme, but I think developing people and having them leave a better person than when they came into your organization can only be a good thing for you.
Yeah. I mean, we've already started out trying to offend people by saying teachers are hoarders. So let's take the next step in that process and say, when we're looking at a culture, like you're talking about developing the whole person, one of the most pervasive cultures in education right now is that you are not a good teacher if you're not the first one in school and the last one to leave. So teachers love being busy. They love to be seen to be busy, but busy doesn't mean effective. It's that conversation we've had already that, well, who's to say that because you spend an extra hour and a half a day in school with the students that you're getting a better result? Who's to say that because you were at school at 7:30 in the morning and you didn't leave to 5:30 and you finished the term before holidays exhausted, that doesn't necessarily make you a good teacher. But there's a culture around that that needs to be addressed, where I've never heard a teacher say, like, I want to be more productive. But yet when you put it in terms like you just put it, well, if you could just, maybe it's like become more efficient at email and more efficient in your collaboration and your communication, and you could save an hour a week and that gives you an extra hour with your children, or you go home less exhausted at the end of the week. Wouldn't that be a good thing? And there's hardly a teacher on the planet that would say, no, I don't want that. But if I say to them, hey, would you like to not take homework home or not have to take assignments home? What if you could get all your work done in work hours and not have to be working at home and during holidays? A lot of teachers would feel very, very embarrassed about that. Like, they wouldn't want to publicly admit that that's how they were operating. And I think there's something around that. This is where we get into that culture and the vision and the what's effective and how do we develop our people. So you start to unpick a bit of a network of like some threads that all start to fold together around what is good teaching, what is performance.
It all comes back to that accountability part, because do we actually know what we're contributing? And if we understand how we contribute to the vision, then we can kind of put a finite, well, not finite, but we can kind of put a bubble around these things that we need to do for the organization and say, that's what I need to do, rather than I need to turn up and be here ready to go, you know, for 9-10 hours a day, every day. And that's going to be my benchmark. So like you said, that is cultural, because that's what you're valuing sitting there. And you know, coming from the corporate world in Coles Myer at the time, that's what they were called. They're now split up, I think, but that's all it was. Did you get there before the boss and did you leave after the boss? And I think sometimes, you know, that's a bad culture from above. I mean, Coles Myer at that time, it was terrible culture. The corporate culture there was awful. It was sweep you out the back door, work you to the bone, burn you out, sweep you out the back door, get the next young person in to do the same thing. I mean, if you want to talk about mismanagement, this is a great one. Their policy for promoting people was such that they wouldn't promote people who were really good at their job, because then they'd have to replace that person and find someone to fit that role. Instead, they were promoting people who weren't fitting their job very well and putting them into level 2, 3, 4 positions over people who were doing a really good job and crushing through the work, because like, how are they going to replace those people who crush through the work? Yeah. So short-sighted, it was all about me. How do I get up the ladder rather than the shared understanding? We're all in this together. We're on this ship sailing in the same direction, which is why that vision and team is so critical, again, to link it back. But yeah, totally agree.
Yeah. So I think we need to just be able to have a look at some of these things and go, okay, so what are we developing here? And being open to that kind of having those discussions anyway. So we've got vision, we've got team and culture, we've got professional development or people development. One of the other elements is learning approach. So if you think about schools, like we've got everything. We've got the 4 C's, which now have been upgraded to the 6 C's. You've got new pedagogies for deep learning. You've got the SAMR model. You've got TPAC models. You've got open innovative learning experiences. You've got blended learning. You've got all, like, pick a buzzword and attach it. It's around. But there's no point going down a path of trying to develop people in a particular skill set or area if you don't know what your learning approach is. And so the way we kind of explain this at a very high level is that you need to have a statement where you can say to students, to parents, to community members, to teachers, that this is how we teach and this is how our students learn. So if you think about it from McKinnon point of view, McKinnon would have from what I've seen of it anyway, like a fairly well-defined, this is the expectations on students. This is how teachers teach. This is how our students learn. This, we use G Suite, we use Chromebooks. Like, it's fairly well designed. It's not come as you want, do as you will. Hopefully we'll get there in the end, right? You've got a strategy, a purpose. Yeah. So you've got a learning approach. You've got a design. So once you've got that design in place, then you go, okay, so what people development do we need to put in place? Who's on our leadership team and what are they owning and how are we driving this forward? And to be honest, at the end of the day, if you're in a space where, you know, maybe you're in conflict with a parent and they're like, well, I don't like it that my child is being treated this way, in one sense, you have the right to say, well, at our school, what we do is this, right? And if you don't like it, then you're going to have to find another school that will like that. So,
and that takes leadership as well. That takes leadership to kind of pull that off and do it well. And you have to have it clearly defined and shared, again, shared understanding of why it's in place, why we're trying to achieve these things. And then also you've got to remember, that's not just like setting it up once and doing a strategic plan and saying, boom, we got it. That's living it, breathing it, and understanding when people come to the school, they understand it. You don't want the new teachers to come and think, oh, this doesn't make sense. I'm not on board with this because I wasn't part of the process and I don't understand it. So it's about that constant understanding and a good induction program for new staff as well. So yeah, I agree. It is a critical step and important to get it right.
Yeah. And I mean, you induct your parents in, right? So as your parents are coming in, you let them know, these are the expectations we have of your child. This is how we're going to teach. This is what we do. And this is how we do it. So, and you need to do a lot of work around that.
Like, should that be like, you know, we have a pedagogical model of how we teach. We have a student management kind of expectation on the student behavior and that kind of thing. Is that what you're talking about? Should we put it up posters? Like, what's the best practice on that?
Yeah, well, so the next element that we can talk about is community engagement. And this is part of that community engagement piece. It's about not just telling parents, giving parents information. Like, one of the things we ask in the survey is, do you have parent information nights or do you have parent education nights? And it sounds like we're just playing with words, but the two are fundamentally different. If you're bringing your parents in to say, here's our glossy brochure, and you know, here's all the information you need to know, then you're probably missing an opportunity. Whereas you could bring in parents, wider community, and say, this is what we do. This is why we do it. This is how we do it. And then give them some education around that point so they understand it. I mean, we see this a lot in New Zealand because they've got fairly modern buildings. open plan, like we're talking high schools with 1,000 students in it and no classrooms. What does that look like? And you have parents whinging and moaning and complaining because they don't understand it. And it's not their fault because they grew up through an education system that was completely different to that. So when we're dealing with primary schools and they're dealing with play-based learning and parents are like, well, all my kid does is sit in the mud and play with cardboard all day. Where's the learning? It's just that the school hasn't done a great job engaging the community and doing some education around that. So once you have your model, play-based learning, open learning environments, whatever it is, then you need to get about educating and working with the community. I mean, this is a space I know you're involved in a lot with iNewsletter. Like half the time, schools wouldn't have a clue who's reading their newsletters, what parts of the newsletter are being read, what's of interest to parents, what's being consumed, what's being missed, and so on. They've got no data around that. And then they do a terrible job of, you know, showcasing the best case scenarios out of the school. Like, look at this amazing learning thing. And then this is why we're doing this. And this is how it links back to our vision. And so you're just constantly promoting the vision and the culture of what we do.
Yeah. The biggest thing we see is schools often aren't sure what their newsletter's for. Mm. So they do a newsletter every week. They have articles every week. But when you say, why do you do it? Oh, well, to keep the parents informed. Well, informed of what? What's the purpose of it? How's it related to your vision? How's it related to your school's success? Oh, they just have to be up to date. Why? Why is there a burning need for them to be up to date? I think it's about just questioning those norms a bit as well, so that you can be clear on what your newsletter's for. Is it for showcasing the very best work? I think it is. And then in that case, why is it private? Why is your newsletter private? This is something we challenge schools on a lot. Is to say, you've got the very best marketing material known to man right here. It's everything good that's happened in your school. You're not promoting bad things. You're promoting everything that's good. You've got success stories. You've got winning, you know, state championships. You got everything good. You want to share that because that's the stuff that's going to build community understanding and that shared understanding in the wider community. But also internally, it's sending a message to students and parents. Hey, this stuff, not only do we value it, but we share it. And we push it out to the wider community. So if you do win something, we're not just going to tell your peers, we're going to tell the community about it. We're going to take that and light it up. So if you're coming to the school and you're new, you know exactly what to focus on and you understand the context of the school you're in that this is what the school values. So there's plenty of exciting things to unpack in there because I've been in the business a long time now, thinking about school communication, thinking about the way parents engage in schools. And one of the best places to look is right at the early years, you know, in childcare centers, in early learning centers. Look at how real time those centers are now. Most of them have these apps that I'm getting an update every day with photos of my kids' activity, something that I can connect with. You know, what did you do today? Oh, I had a good day. What'd you do? Oh, a bit of this and that. You know, we can actually say, I know you did this. Like, tell me about this drawing. Tell me about this painting. How did this come about? Creating those dialogues of which we know through Hattie's work, you know, in his meta-analysis, we know the effect size of parent engagement is really high on student achievement and outcome.
Yeah. And we want to keep some stuff for the community thing. But honestly, when a school says, oh, we've got Seesaw and parents get notified, I'm like, but why? What's the why? Like the teacher's taken random photos of artwork to show that they've done something. Like, what's the purpose of that? So how does that connect back to your learning approach and so on? And it goes beyond that. It's like, how do you do your school assemblies? How do you run your social media? How are you connecting with interested community groups so that you're pulling in resources and expertise and all of that sort of stuff? So yeah, heaps to unpack in that episode. So let's just keep recapping this one. So we've got vision, we've got team and culture, we've got professional or people development, we've got our learning approach. We've got community engagement, and then we've also got infrastructure and technology. And again, this is something that you're very involved in, but I can't tell you how many times schools will ring or email or, you know, and say, what's the best device? And it's like, well, talk to me about your context. Like, what are you trying to achieve here? What's your learning design? There's no point talking about what's the best device in a high school when you're running G Suite and all of a sudden you want to have everyone on an iPad. I've had an email, actually someone hit me up on LinkedIn this week and said, all of our teachers are on iPads and that's the only device they're allowed to use. And teachers are pulling their hair out because their administrative tasks are now taking 2 or 3 times as long. So, you know, maybe there's a reason backed on your learning design and your vision and your culture for teachers to be working off an iPad, but the teachers don't understand what that is. I don't know that anybody in the school probably does, but you need to think that through. So then you're matching your technology and your infrastructure to your learning design and your vision and your culture. And then that's really starts to flow.
And you know, I'd be careful as well, like that exact, that kind of an email. I mean, this is the whole reason we're doing what we're doing, is that we want to bring those two closer together. I do. This is why I'm on the podcast here. And it's to bring that, the technical side closer to the teaching and learning side. So there isn't this kind of thing of, well, we want to do iPad and then we don't have any of the infrastructure to support it, or the infrastructure guy saying we can't do iPad, but the teachers really want to do it. So I think it's about bringing those two together. And it's also about, like, often leaders feel like they have to mandate, they have to do things and be strong in their leadership and push things out. And I agree, there are definitely times for that. But I think with technology, and if you want a culture of innovation, you have to let your staff innovate. You have to reprofessionalize your teachers, not put restraints on them and say you have to work within this really, you know, small box. Is to say, you know, where we can, we're going to open things up. Where we can, we're going to give you freedoms to try things, because you ultimately are going to find the answers to those, and we will learn from that and empower it, rather than one or two or three people in the school making decisions and finding answers for 150 staff. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems to me like the ratios are in the wrong way there. I think it's better if we have the staff making the decisions on their own bat, doing the innovation off their own bat, where and when it's necessary. And we can kind of be facilitators in trying to help them reach their goals and see what their issues are and work with them, instead of saying, well, we've assessed it, in our estimation, this is the best way forward. I think there are times where you need to do that, especially around governance and, you know, legal requirements and things like that in leadership. But when it comes to technology, there's a reason BYOD is in, you know, in every business in the world, is because people want to use what they know. People have certain skill sets that they can exploit. And why take that away from them? Why pull all that back and say, oh no, you've got to use an iPad, even though you're an expert on OneNote and on the PC, and the iPad doesn't have the stuff you need. You know, that's just my two cents. But I think it really is important about leading from the bottom up. And we've spoken about that in this podcast as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that episode too, because I learn a lot from you in that space. You know, quite often as a teacher, we whinge that the internet's not fast enough. And then you were actually showing me graphs and data that the internet's rocking. It's just that the server that's serving the website to me is slow, or the student information system is running slow. And so if you have no metrics on this, then, you know, you end up with a whole bit of a complaining kind of a workplace where things aren't working, but maybe there's a reason why that's not. Or so anyway, we'll unpack a lot of that infrastructure technology side of things in that episode.
And that kind of, is that included in that? Is that kind of environment as well? Like how the technologies are deployed, what the classroom looks like those physical.
Yeah. How do you support it? Because I remember having conversations with you about, well, how, if you're a school and you're spending awful amounts of money on techs and they're not really getting a return for their investment, like, just give me some ballpark figures on, if you've got a school of X amount of teachers, you're probably going to need a tech size of X. Like, where can we put some ballparks? And I remember learning a lot from you about that a few years ago, and then being able to talk to some schools in New Zealand, especially that have control a little bit more over their tech budgets, and principals were blown away, because obviously tech companies come in and tell them that, you know, sell them the dream that it's going to take 15 tech guys to run the school the way you want it to. But when you just narrow your focus and you know what your learning approach is, and you know what your vision and your culture, like, you can refine that back down and you can get some good wins on that. So it'd be good to unpack some of that as well.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah, some broad guidelines. And then the last one is funding and sustainability. So how are you going to fund this thing? Obviously, technology expensive, schooling is expensive. Schools are multi-million dollar businesses in one sense, if you look at it from that point of view. If you're a school leader, you're in charge of multiple staff, big budgets, and quite often ill-equipped to do it in a lot of senses from a preparedness point of view. So if you think about a CEO of a company, they'd, you know, have a lot of training and business knowledge under them. And we, as principals, you pick up what you can and you get some training, but it's not necessarily business acumen as such. And so we need to be really smart in terms about how we fund this. And a classic example of this is in our survey, we ask, if you had to save $100,000 tomorrow, what would you stop what subscriptions or what technology would you stop using? It's amazing to see what comes in from teachers who say, oh yeah, well, the library spends 20 grand a year on this database, which is essentially Google. We'd cut that. And oh yeah, we've got licenses to this tool and nobody really uses it. And So quite often, you know, schools are just signing checks year after year for licenses without really evaluating it. Or they'll get a grant and say someone drops $100,000 on them and they can buy a whole bunch of iPads or Chromebooks, but they don't think about the life cycle of that Chromebook. And then in 3 years' time, they've got to repurchase another 100 Chromebooks. Well, how do we fund it now, but then how do we sustainably fund things?
Yeah, sustainability is really critical. In the last sort of 5 years, I've done a lot of work on making sure that our technology that we have installed in the school, all the capital expenses of projectors and computer labs and all this sort of stuff, each of those have a savings budget put aside. I mean, some people like to lease, but I feel like that just works out more expensive in the long run. If you are in a financial position to purchase that, you know a computer lab is going to last you no less than, depending on the computer lab, but let's say it's 4 years. You might get five, you might get six, but in 4 years, you probably should have the money set aside. You probably should be saving a quarter, you know, one in four over 4 years of that value of those computers, so that in 4 years, you can decide, you can make a choice. Do these devices need to be replaced? Or no, we can probably get five. We can probably maybe get six, or we're too busy this year, let's do it next year. And then you just don't save anything. That money's sitting there in the bank ready for you to spend. So, you know, it's just little things like that that can make a big difference of that long-term thinking. And that seems to be a big theme where when we talk to schools, that's the big difference, isn't it? It's like whether you're talking about vision or, you know, improving your teams or outreach to the community, it's always a short-term thing of like, we'll just run this day or we'll just spend some money on some training. Mm. It's not a long-term thinking of, right, let's put a peer observation plan in that's a permanent part of our professional development plan, or let's put in replacement capital budgets that save for every major expense we have. You know, if you buy network switches or wireless access points or whatever they are, if you're making a big outlay of money, that's just not a one-off thing. You know, you don't want to be surprised in 6 years when you've suddenly got another $100,000 just out of nowhere that you have to spend. Instead, you could divide that over 6 years and save a lot less, be a lot less impactful, a lot less surprise for the business manager. Mm. And then when it is time for you to upgrade, you make the decision. Maybe the money goes back into the school coffers and they can use it for something else because you don't need it anymore. Or no, the money's there, actually going to forge ahead and do that new computer lab or whatever it is.
Yeah, we'll dig into all of that. I've got some horror stories just the way schools are set up, where if you don't spend your budget in the year, you lose it the year after, which just promotes reckless spending and not that saving mindset and things like that. But yeah, so let's just quickly recap on some of that. You got vision, you got team and culture, you got people development or professional development, you got learning approach, community engagement, you've got infrastructure and technology piece of that, and you got funding and sustainability. And so I feel like you can see what I'm saying, right? If you may be really strong in your learning approach and you've got a great team and culture and you've got the best infrastructure in the world, but you're all, you know, your learning approach is all over the place and your community engagement's terrible and parents are hating what you're doing, like it all leaks at that point. And so you can keep piling on team and culture and doing innovative leadership days and so on, but that's not the area that you need to address. So
I think a lot of schools get the sense of this. You know, their panorama reports, that's what they're called in our system, but every system has like a parent survey and a student survey that all gets kind of collated and compared, and that you get a snapshot of that. And how engaged are your parents in the learning? How connected do your kids feel? What's, you know, how much student voice do they feel like they have? All those kind of things. There's actually a role in technology for almost every one of those. And it's exciting to kind of unpack those, you know, deeply in a way that we can say, you know, here are some things you can be doing at your school to impact. If you're struggling with, you know, your parent community, here's some things you can do. And I think that'd be really helpful for a lot of schools. And the other little caveat I have as well, Mike, is I think that, you know, we're talking about, these are all sort of vertical things or horizontal, however you want to see them. But there's also another factor, is that within each of these, there needs to be some form of measurement. And I think measuring your progress against your vision, you know, how are you going in achieving your mission and vision at the school? How are you going with, you know, the student learning systems? It's not just about putting one in. If you have a measurement system, it'll get better because you'll constantly be seeing opportunities for improvement. You'll constantly be getting feedback about those things, whether it's, you know, professional learning or student learning. Pick what the outcomes are, start putting, you know, performance indicators in that you can measure them with. And they don't have to be perfect. You know, we talk about the difference between measurement and indicator. Measurement is like, you know, 10 centimeters. An indicator is a blinker on your car that's just indicating you're going to turn. It's not saying how far you're going to turn. So there's sort of two things to understand there. And I know, Mike, you're big on leading and lag indicators, which is something that's kind of challenged my thinking in the last couple of weeks as well. So very excited to unpick all of that measurement stuff within the context of each of these elements. Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, we use survey data. We survey the staff every 6 months and see how the needle's moving in different areas. And I mean, if you're putting a hell of a lot of effort in and you're not seeing results, you need to ask why that is. And the data.
I had an idea about surveying. Yep. So you know how most people do an annual survey and we'll push out this once a year survey, everyone does it and you look at the results. I feel like that's becoming as useless as an end of year exam, where it's like the damage is already done. You've been messing up for the last 12 months and now we're going to start to take corrective action. We should have just slightly changed our direction 8 months ago and we would have been in a much better spot. Yeah. And so I'm thinking about, you know, if you've got a lot of staff, like we've got over 200 staff in the school, you know, totally with ES. We're probably only at school less than 200 days. Why don't we drip feed that survey out? One person does it every day. And then in every 2 weeks, we take a snapshot of the 10 people that have done it and see where we're moving, see what the trend is. Or, you know, every month or something like that. So we can actually get a bit more of a real-time handle on, are we heading in a bad direction here? Like the last 3 weeks, we've seen a decline in, how well our wireless is going or something like that. So I think that would be really helpful to connect, you know, the laborers, if you like, the people who are kind of doing the work in the classroom or the people who are supporting the work through the, you know, education support staff around the IT or the whatever it is, to really connect their work and what they're doing to the data that you're seeing.
Yeah, we use a concept called the scoreboard. It's like playing a game. If you can't see the score at any particular point in time, when you were talking about lead indicators and lag indicators. So you want to know if you're in front or behind. We talk about this analogy when we're working with schools on this, that you could be playing the game, but if you've got no idea where you are in terms of a score, then people lose motivation and lose interest. Yeah. So when we're doing funding and sustainability and school sets a goal to save $100,000 in printing costs because they're not going to print all their student newsletters and booklets and all the bits and pieces, they're just going to use the internet. How do you know how you're going on that? So we get them to put like the thermometer on the wall and they track in their costs and everyone can see it and there's a celebration at the end. Like, are we falling behind? So where's the data that you want to display that in somewhere where the teachers or the students or the invested parties can see how they're tracking at any particular time?
Yeah, there was some cool stuff in one of the Catholic dioceses up in Tamworth. What's that diocese up there?
Armidale
Diocese. One of the schools I visited there were doing this huge wall, like the whole wall of the common room would have been, you know, as big as this wall behind me here. And the whole thing was covered in student results that were all traffic light system color coded, where you could see the trend. Hmm. And what it did is it just created it had been up there for months, but people were just agonizing over that. You know, look, like the teachers would come up, you know, while they're having their lunch and just look through every result and find the kid that they were just taught and think, oh yeah, he was struggling. Let me see where he's at on this thing. It's just a really like easy, that was low tech, but just a way to kind of immediately see where that student's at. And I feel like often when these things are buried in dashboards and things, you know, random websites, no one's going to take the time to go click in there. But if you're having a conversation about a student or a cohort in the common room, which is often where that happens, let's be honest. And behind you is everyone's progress. I thought it was just an interesting, cool way to do that.
Yeah. And if you want to talk about teacher practice or moving the needle, then making it public where it's not hidden in a dashboard that no one else can see, that'll take you a long way. Getting that change that you want to see.
Yeah. One of the ideas I want to unpack on in this podcast is radical transparency, where, you know, how far can we go with transparency? Why do we immediately put locks on things? Perhaps a lot more things could be transparent and could be public than we first think.
Yeah, no, I look forward to that one for sure. Well, that's the seven elements and we'll start unpacking. We'll do vision next week and then we'll just start working our way through some of these. So really looking forward to that discussion that's coming out and want to just find ways to involve the community around this too. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're got something that you want to say, then you can go to usingtechnologybetter.com and there's a big button where you can leave us a voicemail. You can send us an email, mike@usingtechnologybetter, or just, use hashtag outclasspodcast on any of your socials and we'll see that and pick it up. But we'd love to continue that discussion with you and certainly build that conversation as we're going forward. Hear your stories, hear your frustrations, your pain points. Keen to unpack that with you. Blake, should we jump onto wins and fails for the week?
Yes, let's do it. Wins and fails. Right. Well, where do we start? I think I actually have a fail this week, which is a nice change.
Yeah, bring it on.
So one of the things that I've been quite involved in is the environmental impact of schools and what we're teaching versus what we're doing. And it's just this fail for me where I just see this constantly over and over again where we're teaching about environmental sustainability. That's certainly a big focus, especially in primary schools. It's, you know, huge swaths of time devoted to that. Yet in our schools, in what we actually do, we're not necessarily living it. So if you look at the percentage of schools that would have solar on the roof, you know, a lot of them have little small systems or something really tokenistic. And a large part about that, and I'm just going through this process now, is that the systems that are in place kind of make it hard for us to do that. Like, even if we have the money to spend on it, you know, you're altering your building, so you've got to go through all this, or you you want to do a lease or a rental, and now that's precluded by our purchasing agreement or whatever it is. There's just a million stop gaps there. And I think it wouldn't be hard for these groups, whether it's, you know, the Catholic Diocese actually do a fairly decent job at this, but I know a lot of the state systems in New South Wales and Victoria and everywhere else, there aren't really people in a place to kind of help you do that. And I think that is a huge missed opportunity when you're talking about communities that could benefit from this. You know, you put solar on one school, when are people at school? They're there during the day. When's the sun up during the day? So you could potentially self-consume. You know, we could fill all of our roofs of permanent buildings and self-consume all of that power and not even still be sucking from the grid, but at least we're, you know, 60% of our power needs through the day are met by the solar. I think that would add a huge boost to the community, but also to the mind share of the students that are coming through the school learning about all this stuff, thinking, oh yeah, like the planet's burning or we should do something about that. But, you know, the lights are on in the classroom, the projector's on, like, what's the disconnect here? I'm not really sure. So, you know, it's something that I've been passionate about, and I've just run into roadblock after roadblock with trying to get it in. And it's not just about the money. Obviously it's expensive, but solar pays itself off. I mean, it's a cost positive thing to do in a school. It makes the business case. The issue is really around the implementation of it and all the hoops we have to jump through and the confusion around it as well. And so, you know, when we do get it up and running, I'm hopeful that the team of students that have done it at our school that understand this problem intimately, they understand the kilowatt hours and the feed-in tariff rates and all the other power bill stuff, that hopefully they can, you know, start moving, going out to other schools and talking to them about their journeys with sustainability and help them along the way. Because there are a lot of shortcuts. There is a lot of stuff you need to understand about the solar industry. It has a reputation for being a bit dodgy, but thankfully that's been cleaned up a lot in the last few years. But yeah, I just feel like there's a big fail there. There's this huge missed opportunity. We're hearing about the environment all the time. We see it in front of our eyes. No one wants a dirty environment. We all want to live in a clean environment at the very least. And why that there is a disconnect there, I'm still not sure of. So that's my fail for the moment. That's my rant over.
Yeah, well, maybe the opportunity missed is also for these solar companies to do the work for you. If you look at how technology companies approach education, free everything because they want to get the students exposed to their technology and their products so that they become consumers of it when they leave school. Maybe there's a missed opportunity for some of these companies or governments to do it.
I think so, but they make it so hard. Like, the government keeps it all secret so the companies can never see it, and they put the onus on the school. And again, it's just very, very difficult. And you know, the kids have learned a lot in this process. You know, we've got kids that can really read a power bill properly and understand the science of solar energy and the, you know, the losses in the system and all the nuance and everything. So that's been a fantastic outcome. And I think that's something we want to share as well. But yeah, just getting us over the line, I think it'd be great to see more openness and kind of governments addressing it, putting their money where their mouth is and saying, we're actually going to address this. We're not even going to pay it for you, but just, you know, help us with the bureaucracy machine.
Sounds like you need an election. not another one, please, no. Excellent. I don't have a fail for this week. We do have a win, though. That's been really interesting for us. We've obviously, as a training company, had to transition a lot of our training to online, and we were well positioned for that before COVID hit anyway. But we were just running some fairly large-scale conferences at the moment for this week. And last week, we were running one for Google in New Zealand. And we had over 1,000 teachers register within a couple of days for this online learning environment. And it's very much structured just like a conference. So you come in, there's a keynote speech on the main stage. All the sessions are locked at a certain time. The keynote finishes, the session's all open. You have all the speakers in there. They're doing their thing. And then there's also a networking part. So you just hit, I'm ready to network. It turns your video camera on and your microphone on. If you want, you can turn your camera off if you don't feel that way inclined. And it just randomly assigns you with somebody. You got 3 minutes to network with them and then you're out and you meet somebody else. But if you want to continue the conversation with them, then you can save their details for later. And then you've got an expo hall where you can walk around virtually, obviously, and watch presentations and accept offers and things like that. And I think talking about revolutionizing or changing the way that things are done, this is such a nice way to be able to interact with large scale numbers of teachers in a way that suits them, in the time and the format that suits them as well. And you get recordings later and you don't have to walk into that trade hall. When someone said, I love the expo hall because I don't have to walk in and try not to make eye contact with a salesperson because you know you're going to get stuck in an awkward conversation, but you can still get the information that you want to get. So It's pretty amazing, like these new opportunities for new technologies to start really hit the marketplace.
So one of the things that I think about when I think about virtual conferences is the failure of MOOCs, you know, massive online, what are they, massive online courses?
Yeah.
Where only I think the stats are like 5% of people who register for them actually complete them. Mm. Is that something that you're seeing in this form factor, if you like? Is that something that people are turning up and, you know, just sort of dipping into one thing and then going, all right, I'm out of here. You know, I've got to go pick up the kids or whatever. Whereas when you're actually physically at the conference, you've allotted that time. Like, is that something that's happening, do you reckon?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can't see what people are doing obviously in their houses, but I'll give you the stats. Like we had, I think it was over 100 people online half an hour before the keynote even started. Like teachers had started logging in. Mm. Keynote starts, everybody's in there. And we're doing this in after hours, after school. So teachers are doing this in their own time. They're not getting time out of school for this. And so we were like, oh, we're going to finish. I think it runs from 4 to 6:30. And we were like, oh, it'll be interesting to see the drop off at the end because, you know, got the expo at the end and networking and so on.
People's dinner and everything else. Yeah.
Yeah. But right up until it was close to 7:30, we still had about 80 something people online. So we can see who's online. Now that doesn't mean they're sitting in front of their screen 100% engaged, but the drop off rate was staggering how much people hung around. And they hung around for the sessions and then we called everyone back to the keynote area. And I think between the opening keynote and the closing keynote, we lost maybe 60 people. So if you think about that in terms of percentages, like you'd lose more than that in a physical conference as well. Like how many times do you bump into somebody and you're like, let's go grab a beer or a coffee, or you're doing something else. So quite impressive.
Can't grab a beer at a virtual conference. That's the problem, isn't it?
Well, maybe you can just on your own. But yeah, so the feedback has been really interesting. And I mean, I'm wondering how far we can push this because again, we talk about schools that are struggling with change and transformation. This is probably one area where schools are just like, no, we just want someone to come and stand in front of us and speak at us for a day, which is the worst way to do PD ever. But
digging into that in the transformation framework. For sure.
Yeah. That's
good. Well, to finish it off, my win this week is at our school. We've just instituted a status page. So you'd probably be familiar with those, Mike, where you see them on big websites, have these status dashboards about your services that are up and running. And you might be thinking, why does a school need a status page? And it's actually been born out of a strategic plan we built this year. And there's been a need for about 3 years running for us to improve our visibility in the school, because what we find is working in an IT area is staff don't actually have an appreciation or an understanding of how much is under that IT umbrella. And so often that leads to not in our school, thankfully, but in a lot of schools, it can lead to people being a bit disenfranchised with the IT department, saying, what do you guys actually do in there? You're just on Facebook, you're just playing games. All I ever see is scrolling through Reddit. Yep. There's a lot of that going on. And I think this can just kind of visualize for people, oh, wow, like there's actually 18 different areas from AV to servers to network to boom, 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 like Windows computers, Mac computers, Chromebooks, iPads. Like, okay, you're actually managing a lot of stuff in here. And it's kind of outrageous when you actually write it down and you think, oh, I think, you know, our school's lucky we've got 4 staff that manage all these things. But you know, that's those same 18 things are probably in 90% of schools and they're managed by 1 or 2 people. Mm. And often they're trying to cut those people's hours. So I think it's a good way to sort of promote yourself a little bit. That's kind of the first thing. But the bigger thing for us is that staff have an avenue now to find help. Because what we found is a lot of the feedback was, yeah, you guys are doing a great job. I just hate to interrupt you. You know, you're doing such a fantastic job. I don't want to be a burden to you. So I don't want to check on, you know, what's happening with that job. I don't want to ask you those things. And that's that big middle we're talking about. Mm. They're very quiet. They're the silent majority. The top end and the bottom end tend to be very vocal. very vocal people, you know, real gung-ho at the top end and really kind of question you and give you the third degree about everything at the bottom end. So the middle is that group we want to capture. And what were we not doing for that group? We weren't providing that sort of transparency for them about what's happening in each of those sectors. So this way, you know, when we had an issue with the 3D printer, we had to pull it out of the staff area where it was. We've pulled that out, you know, normally just leave a note like it's broken or something. This way, people can just look on the status page. They see that 3D printer's bought out. They see this, the updates. We're waiting on a logic board. We had this issue. We had this issue. Instead of just, this is taking forever. It's been 3 months. What's going on? If you're giving people updates as they go, obviously they're going to be far more empathetic and understanding. And the beauty of this one is, and the big thing we like about it is, you can actually have all these things are called incidents when something happens. So we had issues with projectors. Power was knocked out because of safety switches that were put in. And we said, you know, these safety switches were messed up. The electrician's coming on Tuesday or whatever day it was. We provide an update when they leave. And you can subscribe. So if you're in R11, that's the classroom you teach in, you can subscribe to that incident yourself. And every time there's an update to it, you only, you know, you get the update. So, you know, we always have this tension of, okay, there's something wrong in rooms, or there's something wrong with a system or an online platform. How many people are affected? Okay, you know, maybe it's a learning management platform. It might be, you know, 30% of the staff use Style or something like that. Do we tell everyone? Do we email staff at? Because we have no way of knowing or ascertaining who's in charge of Style. Probably not. They go to the status page. They can subscribe to the incident themselves. If they come to the window, we can send them an email saying, here's the incident, subscribe to it, and get those updates, you know, tailored for them and curated for them. And that's just good practice in terms of communication strategy, is that you're not blasting everyone all the time with, hey, look at us, look how much we're doing. You're just blasting the people who need to know about it and who are interested and engaged in it.
So I'm trying to visualize this. So you're talking about, I don't know, let's say telephone system, and you've got a green light, an orange light, and a red light. And if the telephone systems are down, it's red. If they're green, if they're up, they're green. Is that the sort of...
That's exactly it. Yep. So we have like AV and projectors. When they're up, it's green. It says operational. And there's a big banner at the top as well, like that collects all of them. So if everything's online, it just says everything's okay. And so that's also good as well. If you go into a room, you're like, oh, the Wi-Fi is slow. And you go up there and you say, oh, no. It might be my computer. Or you go, oh, there is issues in my block. Okay, that's fine. I'll subscribe to that and find out when they're fixed. And so, yeah, whether it's like issues with our Chromebooks, and a lot of the time as well, this is where it differs from a status page you'll find at a company where it's about their product. A lot of the time, this stuff isn't about our offering. It isn't about our offering. It's about, you know, G Suite has a problem. You know, Google Suite has a problem. We'll sort of filter that. Because if we just rely on their dashboard, 99 out of 100 times, the issue they're having on their dashboard doesn't affect us. It's like in the US, or it's somewhere else, or it's to do with a feature we don't use. With this, we filter and we say, oh, Google Sites is down. It's affecting heaps of people. We're getting lots of requests about it. Let's put it on the status page. Let's raise the ticket. People know where to go. Creates a central place for getting help. So that's the hope. They're obviously to address a strategic need that we've had over the last 3 or 4 years that we think we can finally address now. If you want to check it out, you can just go to status.mckinnonsc.vic.edu.au. See what it looks like, have a play around, and yeah, love to hear your feedback as well if you want to tweet at me. Yeah, it's up there. We'll see how it goes. It's, you know, all part of trying to innovate and figure out what works and what doesn't.
So you're just talking about radical transparency. This must be part of that process, right? Making transparent the systems. But you're saying not just transparent to your school. You've made this public, yeah?
Public, yep.
Okay.
That's right. And it's not about being green all the time and just hiding the issues. If everything's green all the time, you know, what's the point? It's all about, hey, this is actually a problem. This is going on. This is impacting lessons, or this is impacting the ability for us to operate as a school. We should be honest about that. We should be forthcoming about that. A lot of the time, it isn't even to do with us. It's to do with the service providers, whether it's the Wi-Fi provider or the, you know, Windows issue that came out last week, or the Mac issue that's going on with projectors or something. So it's just about giving people access to information, yeah, when they need it.
Yeah, that's real cool. And so with that status page, have you found that inbound inquiries into the IT team have dropped dramatically? Like people ring up the phone and say, ah, my projector doesn't work. They go to the status page first and check it. And so you're filtering out a lot of those complaints or inquiries, or hasn't yet happened? You haven't trained the staff enough, or for whatever reason?
Well, we've only kind of soft launched it in a, hey, this is available now. And again, like you said, it's about that cultural change. We need to work on it. Every time there's an inquiry, we need to say, go, you know, here's the incident. Go subscribe to it. We also need to work on our own process and making sure that those incidences are updated. So that's about process management. So including like in our briefings every week, we make sure we refer to the status page, see what is currently down, and then get our staff to do an update in there if there hasn't been an update for a few days. So, mm-hmm. so we've got to build all those procedural things in, and it's just about, like you said, those iterative steps. They're very powerful over a long period of time. So that's where we're heading to now. You know, now that we've got it running, we've toyed with it for probably 24 months, to be honest. It's been in our minds. We've tried various platforms, not liked them. We've finally landed on this, and we think we know, you know, the way we want to implement it. So yeah, it's just about seeing where it lands now and seeing what the feedback is, and eventually hopefully reducing that foot traffic in the office, reducing those interruptions, which are counterproductive to us providing great support, and, you know, getting teachers the information they need when they need it.
That's great.
Keen to and add students, to I should add as well. Students as well.
Yeah, cool. Looking forward to checking it out.
Awesome.
Yeah, excellent. All right. Well, appreciate your time again, Blake. And thanks for listening. If you made it to the end of this one, we do appreciate it. It's been a long one today. So if you're still here, that's hopefully you've got something out of it. Try and leave something good for the end too. So just to keep you listening. And that was gold, if you're asking me. If I was a school, I'd be hitting Blake up and saying, right, show me this system. How does it work? But yeah, looking forward to catching up with you next week. We're going to unpack vision. And yeah, if you haven't told your friends about it, let us know. And we'll help you reach out in different ways. But we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening. For more episodes and show notes, visit utb.fyi/outclassed.